Cool. Y'all recovered from last night? Drink water, drink coffee, maybe some Red Bull. Cool. All right. So, hi, I'm Aesthetics, everyone. And my talk is called Why Names Matter. And there's another talk I just want to reference very quickly before I get into the nature of this. It was at 28C3 called What's in a Name? And it was about the history of names. And while I find that extremely fascinating, I won't be covering it. I just want to do kind of a shout-out because the history of names is equally encompassing for this stuff. This talk is much more about names and how it relates to identity and what the nature of identity is, and in theory, some possible solutions and proposals for how to re-implement this within existing technology architecture. So this is going to be difficult. I've given this talk twice before. The first time I gave it, it lasted an hour and a half before I got cut off. And the second time, it cut out half the deck, and it still lasted like an hour. So I've got like an hour of philosophy and an hour of tech, and I'm trying to boil it down into like 45 minutes or something like that. So if I gloss over anything and you want to know more and I run out of time for Q&A, just come find me afterwards because this stuff is really important, and I'm interested in talking and learning more from people. I basically have two points with this talk because I don't have any solutions yet. It's all kind of an exploration of my own. So if something seems kind of experimental or incomplete, that's because it is. And it's because I'm reaching out and trying to get other people to discuss this. One of the points of the talk is to get people to discuss it. And the other point is to get people to ask questions that I haven't asked yet. I think that's very important. So I want to start off with a couple quick questions. It's hard to see with the lights here, but how many people in here have a name? Hands? Okay. Anyone here who doesn't have a name? Does anybody here have a name they've given themselves? Okay. A few people. So before I get into it, does anybody recognize this picture, this painting? This is my own modification with the V mask, but American Gothic. American Gothic, the very interesting context for this painting, it was painted, it's from 1930 by a guy named Grant Wood, and it was kind of thrown together. The people there, they weren't actually farmers. There's a lot of context and history to it, and it was exhibited in a couple of like art galleries and things like that, and it really didn't get much attention until a couple of people in Iowa decided it didn't actually represent that, the binding, you know, the hand of Puritanism didn't represent them at all. And they started criticizing it and saying, this image does not represent who we are. And at that point, all kinds of controversy began to happen, and that's when it became famous. And that was when it became known to the public eye. So it's very interesting that the image that this projected, when people disagreed with how that image cast upon their identity, that's what made them care about it. So that's kind of what this talk gets about. It's looking both internally and externally into how identity works. So I want to start off with something really quickly. Going back to, anybody here familiar with the Google Plus NIM Wars? Yeah. I couldn't make Eva's talk, but she's very brilliant, and I'm sure it was awesome. I was personally involved in the Google Wars. And before that, I was really, really excited about Google Plus when it came out, to start with the story of it all. I was hyping it to all kinds of people. I went to a family reunion, and I was trying to get my family into it. There's a bunch of really great things that it was solving. There's a bunch of like privacy issues that I had with Facebook. Google was actually really responding to things. The gender privacy controls was something I really liked, where it would actually allow you to have granular privacy settings for how you displayed your gender to people. And they did that because users complained about it, and they listened, and they provided feedback, which is one of the reasons I saw that. And I'm like, so Google's responding and actually doing things about what people think. And maybe they would listen to other things. Unfortunately, it wasn't the case. But it was really pretty, and it answered a lot of questions. And it filled a gap that I needed, and it was awesome. And then this happened. And I'm like, what the fuck? My account got suspended. And this was a little strange. And one thing I want to point out, if you see the link right there, it says community standards on the side. It says after reviewing your profile, we determined the name you provided violates community standards. That was actually a dead link, a 404, on their initial policy. But this got me to ask the question, what is identity? Because I was trying to figure out, well, if they have this real names policy, well, what does that actually mean? So I Googled it, right? And I looked at Google, and here's kind of the definitions that Google had for me. The first one is the fact of being who or what a person or thing is. that doesn't mean that much to me. Okay, the second one, the characteristics determining this, that's also a non-meaning thing. Let's see, serving to establish who the holder, owner, okay, whatever. Four, a close similarity or affinity. So these are all doing relations, comparing objects to each other. And then the last few are mathematical things. And I'm like, okay, well, Google doesn't seem to know. Well, let's see if I can ask some people who are smarter than me. So I went, and there's a quote from Oscar Wilde that's absolutely beautiful. Most people are other people. Their thoughts are someone else's opinions. Their lives a mimicry. Their passions a quotation. Interesting. Chuck Palahniuk, the guy who wrote Fight Club and Invisible Monsters, nothing of me is original. I'm the combined effort of everyone I've ever known. And then I got some stuff from Shakespeare. We know what we are, but not what we may be. There's Gandhi. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. So all these things tell me one thing. These super smart people don't have a clue what identity is either. The beautiful quotes, but they don't really speak to me. So I decided to start trying to figure it out for myself. So two things there that mean a lot to me. The first is Genesis. That's a painting of Adam naming the animals because, of course, if you name something, you hold a degree of power over it, whatever that power relationship might be. The second, of course, is the idea of the royal seal, and that serves multiple purposes. One, you know it comes from the king. The other, it validates things. Has it been tampered with? You know, is this seal, this document which contains my title, which the king has granted me, and I can produce this, that seal which, once you break it, the different ways of establishing identity. And the thing that I want to point out, one of the core elements, identity is not the same thing as a name. Identity is a much bigger, much more nebulous concept. Name, I am defined, and this is my own personal definition, if anyone has an addendum or a change in the definition, I'm open to listening and discussing that. A label that is used to identify a person, thing, or concept within a given context. So, what are contexts? Here are a few examples of contexts, and it's kind of nebulous. So one idea is within a set of groups. So everyone at Hope is within kind of the set of people who are at Hope, although some people leave early. It's, you know, various schedules and whatever. If you work at a company, then all of your coworkers, there is a context and identity you have with all of them and shared relationships. If you're, you know, the staff of something, if you're in a location, if you're a specific time. One of the things that's really interesting, as you get more and more granular, it gets trickier. So, for example, I say in here a specific time, and I say morning, but I don't say when. So the morning, it could be between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. or something like that. 9 p.m., I don't say what time zone. And last week, that could mean any day last week. That could mean the entirety of last week. And interest. Joe likes baseball. That means that he's very different from the Joe who likes hockey. And then suddenly we're getting into things like interest tags and things that are used both to join people together as well as things that you can use to differentiate. So you have two Joes, one who likes baseball, one who likes hockey. And that means there can be multiple people who are called Joe, which means that all these different types of contexts establish the much greater sense of what identity is. So this begins to get a bit more philosophical, and the question, of course, is identity internal and external? One of the most important questions I have here. Anyone here familiar with Freud? A few people. More than that. Okay. So Freud has the idea of the id, the ego, and the superego, that is the carnal, the beast nature of man, as well as the intellect, the primeval, and then the superego, which is the community, the relationships that you share with each other. And it's really interesting because you ask yourself, what drives us? Is it the nature? Like, what establishes human nature? Is it the intellect triumphing over the beast within us? Is it the beast coming out and allowing us to conquer things that would otherwise hold us back? Or is it the people around us who encourage us and collaborate with us? And this then gets into the idea of reputation, which then gets into the idea of trust. So has anyone here seen Citizen Kane, a movie from the 30s? Oh, good, good, okay. By Orson Welles. I love this movie and I love this example because Citizen Kane, the concept of the movie, the main character dies in the beginning of the movie. So the entirety of the movie is actually interviewing all these different people who knew him, trying to construct from their perceptions, from their viewpoints and opinions of him, who he actually was, as you perform effectively getting the integral of his persona and trying to establish who he was. Some people might really like him, some people hate him, people have different relationships to him, and that begins, at least to me, to establish the meaning of the internal versus external relations. And then on top of that, Oscar Wilde is great. The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. One of my favorite quotes. So the conclusions that I've drawn from some of this preliminary research is that the meaning of identity is so complex that neither Shakespeare nor Gandhi can define it. And those guys are really smart. And identity by its very nature is multifaceted. Since identity is context dependent, no person has one single identity. And that's one of the key points in one of the theses of this whole talk. And we'll get into some of that stuff later. But I think that's one of the points where a lot of the technical implementations, I understand there's security measures that they're keeping in mind, but if you really want to start to capture identity and capture relationships, you have to think it through more. So let's take a look at what different kinds of names there are. And this is just like a quick list that I came up with. So you have your birth certificate or the given name. You have a legal name or, as Scud, who was involved in the Nemours, called it, the wallet name, the one that you keep on your, you know, whatever, your driver's license or any documents. The government-issued ID, so your license, your passport, or a social. You have all these student IDs and everything else. One of the things I want to point out about all of these is that they can all be real, like all be completely accurate describing who you are and legitimate, and they can all be completely different at the same time. So an easy example here, imagine that you have a driver's license and a passport, and then you get married and change your name. Suddenly your driver's license has a different last name on it, and yet both your driver's license and your passport are still, you know, perfectly legal documents. Or if you're a doctor, so your employee ID says, you know, doctor on it or something like that. And that gets into questions of tech implementation, trying to do string recognition, and that causes problems if, say, the airline prints up a boarding pass for you, but they screw up so there's not a space between your first and your last name. I ran into this at Border Patrol once. So, different types of names. And this is where there's a lot of confusion here. I'm actually going to get to a point where I've actually concluded now that I reject the notion of a pseudonym, and I'll get to that. But for now, I define a pseudonym more as a nom de plume, which is, to me, a much more elegant and beautiful way to describe it. A name that is not found on any of those previously mentioned documents, and it might even not even be linkable to a document. A polynym is a name of multiple words. So, say, Charles Foster Kane from Citizen Kane. A mononym is a name of just one word, so maybe just Charles. And an anonym is a name which represents anonymity. It's actually kind of debatable whether anonymity exists at all. I want to draw a very important distinction here, though. There's a very big difference between anonymity and pseudonymity, and I think a lot of people don't understand that. A pseudonym is actually something which is identifying to you, and anonymity is attempting to go without a name. And we'll get into that more in a bit. So anyone recognize any of the figures in this, by the way? Yes, good. Okay, cool. So that's Emperor Norton on the right. I'll get to him in a second. He's awesome. At the top, we have Publius, who is the author of the Federalist Papers. Basically, it was actually John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and one other. Thomas Jefferson, thank you. Wrote the Federalist Papers. They were trying to get the Constitution effectively ratified. They had the whole Federalist movement and whatnot. And in order to convince everyone, they began publishing this series of papers and articles in newspapers under the name of Publius. So there were the three of them writing, and people didn't know who it actually was. They had the name Publius attached to it. Therefore, any context or relationships that they may have had, any biases against them based on the name, was gone. And, you know, there was also the Anti-Federalist Papers, which was, you know, against the Constitution and other things. But it was just very interesting that the idea that a name could influence things so much, they tried to effectively publish under that pseudonym. One of my favorites is Emperor Norton I. If anyone's read Sandman, sweet. Yeah, he's famous in San Francisco lore. He was in San Francisco in, I think, the mid to late 1800s. He was he was doing something in the trade, and then the economy tanked, or he lost a lot of money, and he went broke, and he kind of went insane, declared himself the Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, sent a letter to the San Francisco Chronicle, and because it's Bay Area, everyone went along with it. So there he is in his formal, you know, His Majesty's gear, and the best part was he actually issued his own currency, and stores took it. So, yeah, he's also one of the saints of Discordians. So Nicholas Bourbaki, anyone heard of him?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. Of course you have. You're a mathematician. Was it in the 1930s? It was a group of, I think, French mathematicians who tried to rewrite mathematics from the ground up. And all of their work, they published under the name of Nicholas Bourbaki, which is really, really, I mean, there's a number of reasons. That it was kind of a secret society type thing. And there was a bunch of stuff going on there. But very fascinating. The whole group of people was all publishing under a single name like that. Other instances where pseudonyms or nom de plumes, as I call them, are incredibly useful. Richard Bachman, a.k.a. Stephen King, he tried to publish under a different name to see how it would go. Voltaire, who published Candide under a pseudonym partly because the King of France wanted to kill whoever wrote that book. Yeah. The Bronte sisters, who actually published their work, was it Charlotte and Emily, I think? They published their work under a male name because they couldn't get published because they were women. Many, many other examples of why pseudonyms are important and why people have used them in the past. Those are just a few. So here's a quick example that I don't know if anyone remembers this. This is all a bit dated because this was from last year. I have some new philosophy stuff, though. But this was Penn Jillette at the time had 1.7 million Twitter followers. And he had this beautiful quote he posted on Twitter from MLK. "I mourn the loss of thousands of precious lives, but I will not rejoice in the death of one, not even an enemy." Really, really great. Only one problem. It wasn't by MLK. And he issues this apology. "You know, I checked a long quote from MLK, Strength to Love, and that spoke to some of my feelings, and I cut and pasted an altered hunk," and he apologizes. One other interesting thing I want to point out here in the first encounter that we have with how this works within tech. Notice at the bottom, I don't know how you can see it. See how it says retweeted by somebody and 50 others? So this is the apology. I'll go back a slide. This one says retweeted by 100 plus others. So it's really interesting that somebody corrects themselves and people didn't retweet the correction as much. So there's a number of questions as to why they did it. Maybe it showed up in news articles and they didn't feel the need to retweet it. Maybe they felt personally guilty because they were dumb enough to retweet something that was like inaccurate to begin with. But we'll get into that in a bit. So I wanted to just quickly dive into some solid examples here of where names, really the question is, do names matter or do they not matter in terms of establishing identity? Is there anyone here who's not heard of WikiLeaks? Okay, you don't belong here. One of the things, everyone has their own opinion on the topic and the debacle and whatnot, but one thing that Assange said that I found really, really interesting, he said that the source of the material does not matter, it is the content that matters and the ideas that are out there, and which is one of the reasons they try to separate the source from the material, the idea being that the source can bias things, the source can delegitimize things or re-legitimize things, and he wanted the content to effectively live up and be validated on its own accord. And that brings the question of, do we lend credibility to things? Do we validate things based on who said it or based on the thing itself? Based on, do we read a book because it's a good book, or do we read it because we want to think it's good because we read another book by that author or because we heard that author was great? Did anyone hear about porn WikiLeaks? So porn WikiLeaks, this happened last year. The adult film industry has this thing called Adult Information Medical Database, where all the adult film actors and actresses submit blood test scores, like, you know, HIV test results and things like this, and it was kept in a centralized database, and it was compromised. And a site went up last year. It was taken down by the FBI, one of the few takedowns I'm actually okay with, which had the entire database, and it was mapping stage names of porn people to their legal names, as I call them. And in some cases, it had driver's licenses and things like that, and a lot of other information. And anyone who has ever even danced in that train can tell why that would be really, really damning and dangerous, you know, because, you know, imagine your driver's license has your old home on it that your parents live at, and then one day a dead cat shows up on their doorstep. That kind of stuff does happen. So that's something to keep in mind. That's one of the reasons that multiple identities can be very useful, because you have all these different contexts, and people in one context might not appreciate people in another context. Another example, slightly less triggering and alarming, was AOL and Netflix databases, things like that. Did anyone keep up with it? This was a few years ago. So the AOL database, that they released a record of a couple hundred thousand, I think, search logs. And based on the search results, people were actually able to reconstruct, by virtue of just the searches and the order in which they did them, who the identity of the people that did the searches were. Netflix ran into something like this based on the ratings of movies and the movies that were watched, and they were able to reconstruct who it was and construct the social graphs and things like that. There was also, does anybody remember the Wikipedia SJ controversy? This was in, I think, 2006. There was a guy who was on Wikipedia. He was actually a fairly high-level editor, and he was making a number of posts, and he claimed that he had, I think, 2 degrees, one in divinity and maybe one in jurisprudence or something like that. And he was involved in all these debates. People took him seriously. And it turned out that he was actually, I think, a 22-year-old college dropout living in Louisville, Kentucky. And it's just, people took him seriously, and it's like, well, maybe he really was that smart. And if you don't know who it actually is, and you take it based on the content they produce and the discussions that they have, and then you compare that to somebody else who actually does have those credentials, it makes you start to ask what the point of credentials is. So I want to step back. Oh, shit. I want to step back for a moment and just explore just different types of social networks, because we were looking at interests and common links before. And I think that all of these can serve as social networks. And some of these are fairly obvious. You have book groups, corporations, so everyone who works at a company together. You have events. And events, of course, are limited by time. And some events might last a week. And within that week, it's kind of a temporary autonomous zone in which, the social network is created and then expires. And then maybe relationships will happen later on. Courtrooms, this is interesting because the other thing that happens with social networks, not only do relationships develop, but people also assume roles within those relationships. So a courtroom is an easy example. What are the roles? You have the judge, you have the jury, you have the prosecutor, you have the defendant, and all the different roles. Well, they're regular people when they leave the courthouse, right? You have lunch with them and talk about, Google or something like that. It's when they step into that social network, into the context of the courtroom, that they assume the skills, the roles that are ascribed to those titles. When you call somebody something, it can often change how they act to you. So, and other things, like you have a cause. People get together because they want to help support something, like, stopping breast cancer, things like that. So this is just something to think about. I'm happy to go into more detail with any of these later. So I'm trying to define here, at least, a social network as a force that brings people together, or people or their personas. And that's very fascinating because that means that you don't actually have to be in flesh meeting with them, and their personas together on a regular basis. A friend is a person that you would choose to be in contact with. And that gets really interesting because you may feel like you have a relation to somebody because you follow them on Twitter. Maybe you've never met them. Maybe you've never had a back-and-forth communication with them, but you still consider them to be part of your network. But they wouldn't be a friend. I'm defining friend here as something. It's all really nebulous. So social networks, I ascribe them as being these context systems that basically try to help solve namespace collisions. And I'll get into examples of that in a minute. So a couple of more technical things I want to cover, like vocab words and whatnot. Intrapersonal versus interpersonal communication. Intrapersonal is the internal dialogue you have with yourself. You're conscious and, thinking through things and whatnot. Your interpersonal is conversations and relations you have with each other, with other people. So internal versus external in that sense. Anyone here know about Dunbar's number? Dr. Robin Dunbar did a study in 1992, looked over, among other things, studied the size of primates, their brains, and looked and found a direct correlation between the size of their brains and the size of the social group that they maintained. And actually did some mathematics and found that us, Homo sapiens sapiens, tend to have an average social group size of about, it's usually rounded to around 150. The number changes, and there are debates as to what the number might actually be, and I think it may change based on who it is. So Dr. Cameron Marlowe did a follow-up study with Facebook in 2009 and actually found that the number of friends somebody has on Facebook, by which I mean the number of people they actively communicate with and seem to know, usually range from about 120 to 150. And also, those people tended to have a smaller, close circle of friends, usually between 5 and 7, I think the numbers are. So this is one of the key points of the whole talk, and this is, I could actually give an entire talk just on this. Hans, who here knows who Joseph Campbell was? Yes. Okay. And this is how I'm going to start to explore the hacker handles question and why they matter. So Joseph Campbell, he is a famous mythologist. He passed away in the late 80s, but he had this concept that it was a series of lectures as well as a book series that was called Mythos. He also has interviews that he did with Bill Moyers. Fascinating man. He did some of the most groundbreaking work I've ever seen in mythology studies. He has this idea that he conveys called the right-hand path and left-hand path, and it's a path that you go through life with. So the right-hand path, just to give the quick summary, is the community from which you come. So the structure of society and the norms and the cultural ideas that come with them. The left-hand path is more the hero's journey type thing, the person who splits off and goes off and discovers things for themselves. And hero's journey has a number of different elements to it. You have easy examples of this. Has anyone here seen Star Wars? No? Okay, I only saw like two hands. Yeah. George Lucas credits a lot of the thinking into developing Star Wars to Joseph Campbell and Hero's Journey and all of that. If you've ever seen The Matrix, it follows the same idea where there's a call to adventure, or you can kind of see it there. There's a call to adventure, the call to action, where something hoists you up, or as Neo gets, you know, the follow the right white rabbit message. And then along the way, you get all these challenges, and if you respond to them and follow through and carry through with them, it starts to build up your character until at some point you hit revelations. And the whole idea of this is basically going through experiences and building up your character and discovering who it is that you actually are. And of course, as we go through life, it's a constant process. And then near the end, you have transformation, where you effectively take those ideas and reintegrate them into yourself. And then the atonement, where you come back, you become at one with yourself. And then you return back to the same place that you are. But, you know, you're the same person, right? Or are you very different? So the right-hand path, just to reiterate, right-hand path is the structure. The structure which is instilled in you by society. The left-hand path is much more, some people would describe it as the chaos. It's you wandering through. It's when you make mistakes and you learn from them and you build them back in. Another interesting the top part of that circle, the known versus the bottom part is the unknown. So this is borrowed partly from Carl Jung and the idea of the symbols and the meanings within symbols. But you can also relate that the known is the word, and the unknown is the meaning ascribed to the word, because you can't ever know what fully somebody thinks a word means. So, who here can guess why hacker handles come into this? Anyone? What do you think? They provide freedom, yes. So if you consider a hacker handle, it's a name that you don on yourself, right? It's a given name. And maybe it's something that you do in folly. Maybe you hop into IRC for a minute and you hang around and then you leave, or you become a former hacker, as some people call it. Or you put your toe in the water and you feel it. And then you put your whole foot in the water and you feel it a bit more and you become more accustomed to that context and culture. Maybe maybe you have a whole leg into it. And what you're really doing, in my opinion, is you're stepping into the paradigm, into the context that dynamic and that community has for you. So rather than, as some people say, the right-hand path of the structure, you're stepping outside of that paradigm and stepping into a new one, which is self-discovery. And then as you leave that culture, you discover that other people from other cultures have left. But they haven't really left, have they? They're still there. There's parts of that culture that are with them as they carry them through. And people who are wandering along becoming themselves and part of another culture. So hacker handles, of course, if you don a name for folly, well, maybe it'll start to grow. And maybe you can use that name to explore who you are and explore a new angle of yourself. We'll get into some of, Chris Poole stuff in a moment. But just to dwell on that for a moment, here's a quick example that I can use. How many people have ever worn a tie to work? Right. You get treated a lot differently than when you wear a T-shirt, right? And that's something that you exude. And some people feel, you know, they wear more expensive clothes and they act a different way. You convey a different message. It changes the way that people act to you. So the example that I've used in this is I can introduce myself by my legal name and people treat me in one way. I'll introduce myself by a handle. I get treated in a very different way. And it allows me to step outside of the context that I was in, step into a new one. And the fascinating part about that, and some of the things I'm still exploring right now, is that actually allows me to experience life as somebody with fewer privileges. And that becomes really interesting if you think about it. So stepping back into the tech for a moment, bring an identity online. First example here is Nissan.com. Does anybody know about this one? So Nissan, you think the car company, something like that, right? Well, it turns out there's actually a guy, his family name is Nissan, and he had Nissan.com, he registered in like 94, and Nissan has been fighting to get that. Just this dude who owns a computer repair company, I think, and there's been ongoing lawsuits, and the website eventually turned in a document in all the lawsuits from Nissan trying to take the name from him. This is my favorite example here, Whitehouse.com. Anyone remember this from the 90s? Yeah, actually, I had to go to Internet Archive to get that image, mostly because I just wanted to show porn in my talk. Yay. Don't worry, there's no goatee here. But think about that for a second, the namespace issues, because people expect something when they go somewhere. So imagine the elementary school teacher who's teaching their kids about computers in 95, and they go, let's go see what the president is. Oh, my God. And Cyber Squad, and just to provide a quick definition, is when I say I register TomCruise.com and then charge Tom Cruise $1 million for it. And that gets into legal stuff, too. To wax technical again for a bit, just to provide context in like what online identity actually is, HTTP headers and all these different things. So looking at access times, which URLs you access, things like that, without knowing any name or anything like that, just like with Binny's keynote where he said the name is the least reliable way to identify someone, look at their access times, look at the URL they access, things like that. What if they try to access something and they get denied, and then they try to access it a minute later again and it's accepted? Maybe they had to log in. Maybe it was them the first time and they just got denied because they hadn't logged in yet. Access times, you can take a look at. You know, a lot of people do things from a 9 to 5, but where is that 9 to 5? What time zone it is? And you can actually look at traces to find out what time zone malware is coming from. Some of this, I think Eva probably covered some of this stuff in her talk. IP addresses, that's, you have an IP address, but if you're part of a corporation and the corporation has one external IP address that everyone can see, well, it's kind of hard to determine which person in that 10,000-person corporation it is. So then there's other additional questions, like how can a website confirm that you are you? And this is a really hard question. It's like, do we do passwords? If so, what kind of passwords are there? Do we have CAPTCHAs? Or what if CAPTCHA gets broken? What if we get spammed? Things like that. What does it matter? So I'll open this one with a quick question, because this gets into transparency and privacy and everything else. How many people here, hands up, have a Facebook account? Okay, a lot of people. Keep your hands up, I'm sorry. How many of you have your jobs posted on Facebook? Okay, how many of you have your salary posted? Right. So what does transparency actually mean? What elements of ourselves are we putting out there? Most people I know don't want to share their salary, although if you're working for a nonprofit or the government, it's public. That gets into some other things, but then we have the question, is there such thing as a full transparency? Do you want a sex tape of yourself to be put online? Who is it that you want to grant that access to? And most importantly, who decides how transparent we get to be? And this goes back into the Google Plus stuff a little bit, goes back into the Facebook stuff, goes back into the government stuff. Who decides? Do you decide or does the government decide for you? So final point here, active versus passive communication of that information. So the example I can use here, you have broadcast media where you're put in something out in a newsletter and all these people receive it. You know, if they get emails or whatever else, it gets on CNN. Passive communication is when that information is available, but you kind of have to ask for it. Easiest example of this is a FOIA request. You send a request for the government for that information. It's technically public. It's technically transparent, but it might take a year for you to get it. And they're certainly not going to put that out there. So here's just some privacy-promoting tech that works in all this. Using Tor, the Onion Router allows you to use the web anonymously. Using selective login, you can turn off login within your servers. Privacy and sharing on websites, things like that, which, you know, do I want my gender shown to people? Remailers, that is basically if I send an email to somebody, but it goes to the remailer, it does kind of a man in the middle, strips all the headers from it, and forwards effectively the content of the message without who it was that sent it. And I have Hilaris here because it's a Discordian thing, but it's also because Len Sassman was the maintainer of Mixmaster, which was one of the remailers, and he unfortunately passed away last year, so I wanted to make sure I had something to remember him there. So as we're just looking at all these things, we run into, well, here's some of the problems that we get with online identity. Sock puppets are when people create accounts. This happens in Wikipedia a lot. If you create an account to do, like a little one-off account to do something, but then you go and create another one-off account, a lot of malware does this if it tries to, trying to think of a good example. Reddit is a place where this happens. Somebody creates a temp account and it does something to try to, you know, upvote things or things like that. Anonymous Coward, this comes from Slashdot back in the 90s where somebody didn't want to post under either their real name or their, handle, whatever they overuse, and mostly because they didn't want it tied back to them. And sometimes people post very different things if they have the anonymity of knowing it won't come back to them, and I don't think it's always malicious. Cyberstalking gets very tricky. There are definite reasons why people need to use handles or pseudonyms or none of the plumes or whatever. Imagine if you have a stalker. Imagine if somebody's trying to kill you. Why does a witness protection program exist? Then you have things like DDoS attacks, and that gets back into IP addresses, and it's more technical, but it's like, well, how do you keep out somebody who's causing problems, which is the base of what that is. So here's a couple questions, or I'm sorry, here's a couple of quotes. This one is from Eric Schmidt, executive chairman, former CEO of Google. This quote is from Techonomy, August 2010. The only way to manage this, by which he means the transparency issue, is true transparency and no anonymity. In a world of asynchronous threats, it is too dangerous for there not to be some way to identify you. We need a verified name service for people. Governments will demand it. Who agrees with that? I also want to point out here there actually is a government initiative that's being worked on. It's called NISTIC, National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. I'm still torn on what my opinion of it is, but there are several government attempts to, like, figure out a way to do identity online. Here's another quote from him, and this one hits home. If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. This is coming from the executive chairman at Google. What do you guys think about that? Who wants Eric Schmidt to tell you what you should do?
I want to know what he does.
Yeah, what I don't want to know what he does. God. That's a sex tape I don't think should be released. So here's our friend Mark Zuckerberg, CEO at Facebook. I'm sure you've heard of him. The days of you having a different image for your work friends or coworkers and for the other people you know are probably coming to an end pretty quickly. Having two identities for yourself and is an example of lack of integrity, and this is from 2011. Really? Zuckerberg telling us what integrity means, huh? And this is interesting. It goes back into the agency question. It's like, does he decide this? I mean, obviously he doesn't really know how to handle privacy settings very well. But it's really interesting that they seem to view this one itis, this having one online identity, is a sign of integrity, of conforming perhaps with that right-hand path, that system. So here's another of my favorite quotes. I'm sure you're all friends with this guy. Chris Poole, founder of 4chan. I love this quote. The portrait of identity online is often painted in black and white. Who you are online is who you are offline. Human identity doesn't work like that, online or offline. It's not who you share with, it's who you share as. And, of course, one of the theses of my talk now, identity is prismatic. So to borrow some physics, you have a prism and you shine the white light through it and you broadcast the rainbow. And I think the rainbow is much more indicative of who somebody is. And if you think about it, all the different ways and all the different means you have by describing somebody, that is kind of the prism of the person. I think it's a lot more beautiful, too. Getting back technical for a moment, just the different types of relations that you can have. Facebook, asynchronous means that you send a request to them and they have to approve of it, as opposed to Twitter, where you can just follow somebody, unless, of course, they have a protected account. And there's a number of ways that they've tried to implement these types of social networks online. You have blog platforms like, you know, Blogspot and things like that, and you can kind of do RSS feeds if you have a whole bunch that you want to follow. You can link them together. There's plugins for WordPress that you can use, but anyone remember WebRings? Kind of reminds me of that. Google Plus was working on the asynchronous circles. I thought that was a pretty cool thing. My favorite, of course, is Diaspora. Does anybody here know of Diaspora? Oh, good. Okay. Some people do. Diaspora is, not only is it asynchronous, but it's also decentralized. The rest of these, Facebook, Twitter, and all that is centralized, by which I mean there is a walled garden of servers that you don't have access to, whereas Diaspora, it's open source, and you can actually download it and install it for yourself. Here's another thing just talking about online privacy and such that I wanted to touch on. EFF, this data is actually from last year. They have new data that came out, but I can't get it to format in the slide as well. They went through a whole bunch of court cases, and they draw up this kind of a rating guide on who has your back. And because I'm about to badmouth Google pretty hard, I did want to say that they're doing some pretty good things. You know, they got gold stars in fighting for user privacy and things like that. I think at this point, Twitter might be my favorite, though, given the lawsuits that have been going on. But, you know, this is, of course, you can check it out, whohasyourback.eff.org. But I do want to say that Google has some really cool stuff they're working on. So I want to get into the next thing here, which is the whole real names policy. We encountered that before when, you know, the initial suspension happened. Well, the question is, well, doesn't everyone have a real names policy? It turns out, well, yeah, Facebook has one. Here it is. interesting, if you read through it, though, real names is not defined, and it's kind of a case-by-case thing. You don't really hear about people getting suspended from Facebook that much for names things, do you? There are legitimate reasons, you know, if they're posting child porn, stuff like that, but they don't seem to enforce it in quite the same way. So here is Google's original names, real names policy as of the time which I got suspended, which was back in, I think, July of 2011. To help fight spam and prevent fake profiles, use the name your friends, family, coworkers call you. Okay, that works for me. Cool, great, whatever, let's go on. But they don't really enforce it that well. This is a famous quote from Andrew Jackson, who there was a Supreme Court ruling, and he said, okay, well, you're the Chief Justice, but let's see what you do. You go ahead and enforce it, because I'm not going to. And the fight between the balance of powers in government. So both Facebook and Google Plus have a real names policy. Let's see how Google enforces theirs. So these are the emails that I went through. I got suspended. I fill out the appeal form that they gave. There was a link for an appeals form. So July 23rd, I filled it out. July 25th, I got it back from a friendly guy named Neil, part of the support team. He contacts me to initiate the process. I reply, oh, of course, great. July 26th, he tells me aesthetics is not a common name. Asks me to confirm it is my common name. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, here. I send him an email. I confirm, and I was wondering, is that good enough? I get an ID back, saying they need a government-issued ID to confirm my name as aesthetics. And I'm like, I don't know what fucking planet you're living on, but really? So I reply to this to confirm that they define a common name exclusively as the name on a government-issued ID. Also, I asked what their policy for handling government IDs is, because what am I going to do, scan in a driver's license and send it as an email attachment to them? Like, what the fuck? Do they have a policy? Are they going to delete the image? What servers is it held on? I want to know this stuff. I don't know about you guys, I considered a driver's license or any kind of state-issued ID sensitive information. Last night was way too much fun. July 28th. This. Your common name does not have to be the name on your ID. I need to get the name off your ID to confirm that your name is aesthetics. And again, I guess he lives on Mars. My reply. So if the name is the only thing that you need, can you use the information I provided in my appeal to make the same judgment? I'm confused as to why it must be a government-issued ID. I think that's a very reasonable, valid question. Here's the response. Thank you for contacting us with regard to the name you want to use with Google profile. After further review, we have determined that your name is within our community standards policy. Thank you for your patience while we reviewed your profile name. I will just trust that it is your real name. Most users just try to explain that it is the pseudonym they have always used. And I get suspended again 2 weeks later. Yeah, and actually that's the point where I said fuck it and I left. Although the interesting thing there, they actually did listen and they adjusted their real names policy a bit, but it's still there, and that's the problem I have with it. This is one of the fundamental problems I have with all this stuff going on. I no longer use Google+. I will not until they come out and publicly retract everything that they've done. That is my personal view. Anybody else can do whatever they want. So here's some other people that ran into this kerfuffle as well. This is Doc Popular on the right. That's his blog on the left. He does a lot of cool, he makes games and plays music. He's a really good guy. Here is Sai. Is Sai in the room right now? Oh, there you are. Hey, Sai. Yeah, see, that's his driver's license, sensitive info redacted. He said it was okay to have this in here. Notice just the three letters. That's his name. That is your full legal name, yeah. Works for me. It's a mononym. This is also when Doc Pop got suspended. He said, fuck you, Google, and he decided to change this. And if you can see the tagline down there, yeah, made up a fake name because Google wouldn't let me use my real one. Yeah, Shani Jardin posted this. It was really funny. So here's some lessons I learned from the Google Plus fiasco. Google doesn't know what a common name is. Yeah, I couldn't get a straight answer out of them, common name versus real name or whatever else. Google is demanding sensitive information without any security procedures or policies in place. If you know someone at Google, you'll be fine. When I was going through this, I made deliberate efforts not to contact anyone. Everything I did was just via Twitter. I guess people were following me and said something internally, maybe. I don't know. I also haven't asked about it. Also, Google, just like everyone else, doesn't have a clue what identity means. That's really important. So some closing remarks on all of this. I mean, like I said, it's not conclusive. It's to try to get some discussion going. Here are just some projects that I see that are going in the right direction. Has anyone here seen or heard of or used WikiTrust? One of the primary problems of Wikipedia is that how do you know that the information on there is legit? Somebody could come in and just like put in an edit. WikiTrust is actually a series of algorithms, great white papers and such, that explores based on text that is entered after how many number of edits, whether it's moved, removed, things like that. And I think it's a Firefox plugin you can download onto a wiki page that will actually change the color of the text based on how reliable, based on their algorithm, the text is, which is pretty useful, I think. Hypothesis, some friends of mine are working on this. It's basically, they're approaching reputation and identity in a really interesting way. So let's say that you use Reddit. It will recommend other pages and things like that based on other pages you look at, right? So if you go to a whole bunch of pages that are Rush Limbaugh related, you're probably going to get recommended Rush Limbaugh stuff. What Hypothesis seems to be doing, it's still in beta, but they're really good guys. It's an annotation system. So let's say that I have a legal document, some case law, and I highlight some jargon, and I want to write an annotation on what my interpretation of that is. I can start a context thread and have discussions with people, and you can upvote or downvote somebody's comment. But then they recommend other links and things like that, not based on what you've looked at, but based on what you have upvoted. And they do it based on your comments, which I think is much more reasonable and realistic. The other interesting thing that I like about them is you can't upvote or downvote on a comment unless you've replied to it already. And here's Diaspora, and I'm really happy that Mitch did the Geeks and Depression panel because Ilya Z also passed away last year. He was involved in Diaspora. Both were suicides, so hopefully we won't have any more of those as long as the depression stuff is going on. Diaspora, I think those guys are really, really doing something good. The concept that they're working with is, I think, where the future of things need to be. It's a decentralized social networking system, by which I mean, let's say that I want to say... So Facebook is centralized. You create an account, and it's all on their server, whereas Diaspora, I can download it, install it on my system, and my friend who is in San Francisco can install it on their system. Independent systems, I own everything on it. I control all the privacy settings and everything, and yet they can still talk to each other. Amazing how that works, isn't it? So that's the fundamental core of what they're trying to do. I think it's great. Happy to talk more about any of this stuff with anyone after. I think they're actually they had some rocky things, but they're going through a new round of funding right now. So hopefully either they will create something that's really awesome or they'll inspire others to. Let's see. So a few final closing remarks on all this. Explore decentralized systems like Diaspora, things like that. All current solutions fail in some way. Everything, all of them do. Passwords fail, captchas fail, everything else. Any form to try to identify somebody. Enforcing a real names thing, well, that doesn't work because there's no such thing as a real name. I don't think, because if you call something a real name, that implies that name has legitimacy and any other name doesn't. If you call it a legal name, something which is issued by the government, that's something I much more accept because I can call a driver's license a legal name, sure. Real name? Is there any such thing as a real name? Right. Context dependent. And I would say join or support efforts like Diaspora, Hypothesis, WikiTrust, etc. So that's what I got for you right now. Any questions? Do I have time for questions? Okay. Oh, I have 10 minutes. Okay. Actually, I think it looks like 5 minutes. I want to make time for the next speaker. So, okay, 5 minutes for questions. Is there a microphone that the people can ask questions into? What's that? Okay, what's your question? Right. The answer is a guy named Vic Indutra. I've talked to many people inside of Google about this, and the answer to me, my impression seems to be hubris. It seems to be they just don't give a shit. There was actually a document that came out, I think on geekfeminism.com, listing all the reasons why pseudonyms are important, and apparently they just fucking ignored it. By they, I mean Vic. So I didn't get into this in the talk because I had too much info and not enough time, but Vic Indutra is the Google executive in charge of Google+. He is the single person holding back the real names policy. So when he came out at the Web 2.0 conference last year and he said that we're adjusting it to allow pseudonyms, he didn't really get into detail about what that was. And then we see the real names policy they have now, which I think Eva went over in her talk, which, yeah, I guess if you're famous, you can use a pseudonym like Lady Gaga, but I guess Google determines if you're famous, just like they determine if you have a real name. So I can answer this more after the talk because I have a really complicated answer to that. There's no legal reason as far as I know. In fact, I don't know of too many examples of people even being asked for a government-issued ID. I would not do it unless they have, like, some... if they have policies in place or if they need to collect for, like, a government reason,
I can deal with that, you know, because as reliable as the government may or may not be, at least they have policies and procedures in place to deal with that. I asked Google, and they didn't seem to have any procedures. Yes, question.
Well, I went through the same bullshit with Google Plus.
Okay.
But don't you think that if we give up this easy way, it will get worse?
Oh, I'm not. Oh, the question was, the guy went through the, Val is his name. Yeah, went through the same bullshit as I did, and you said if you get, we give up this easily, won't it just get worse? Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm not giving up at all. That's why I'm giving this talk. I'm trying to get people to think about it so we can come up with a better solution. The solution that we had initially was just to, say, abandon Google+, and if you actually look at interviews where Vic and others get asked, whoa, how many people are at Google+? How many users are there? Notice that they always answer, you have to look at Google+ for the entirety of what it is. By which I guess that means that they forced everyone who is a Google user into Google Plus to conflate their numbers. One quick example of this I can give is when they did the search Plus Your World, I actually checked. I was opted into it without my consent. I hadn't logged into Google Plus in like 6 months, and sure enough, I was part of their system, so they were doing mining on me. So what is a Google Plus user? It seems to be nebulous. One way to attack it is to stop using it and try to create your own. And yes, I hope there are more efforts like that. Question. The SPI, what is it?
Spooky,
SCSI. No, I'm not.
So the idea, it was a distributed public key infrastructure that had no certificate authorities.
Distributed public key infrastructure that had no, what?
No certificate authorities.
Okay.
So, but names were not tied to external
identifiers. Names, okay, yeah, yeah.
So every name was a pack. So you would say, like, you are the person that I call it that is.
Right. Okay, so names were not tied to paths, and they use context, I guess, rather than names itself. Yeah, names are actually, like Vinny said in his keynote, names are a really bad way to try to identify somebody.
So it's fundamentally a way to tie keys to human memorable names.
Right. Which works until your key gets compromised.
Sure.
Or until your key expires or something like that. But no, I'm totally down with that. I mean, wait, SSL is awesome too, and all these. There are security ways to do this, but they all have their failure points. When trying to replicate what it seems that online social or what real social networks, by which I mean like MeetSpace, are all about. There were actually a couple examples with Google where somebody took an ID and like changed it around and like added some fake shit in there, sent it to Google, and they actually like reinstated his account. So, am I getting kicked off yet, or can I take another question? 54. Okay, one more question. Over. Okay, somebody shout. Right in the back.
Would you mind addressing on the notion of what Prince said in his copyright problem? Where he said about the sonic
music. I could. What was the question about?
Would you comment on the notion of using a sign as your name?
A sign as your name? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, notice I said it's a label. I didn't say that it was a letter or a word. I mean, a letter is just a symbol as well. We have a set of, by we, I mean Americans and like the Western culture, we have a set of symbols that we use, but, you know, the Russians have Cyrillic and they can read that just fine. If you look at the history of language and all the different, that's why the Rosetta Stone was so important. I mean, it's the way in which we communicate, and anything can be a symbol in my opinion. It's just a matter of who understands what meaning is ascribed to it. So, yes, absolutely, I think it's valid. The question is, does it work with existing systems or do we have to create new systems to work better with it? Does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, so I guess that was the last question. Or I'll take one more. I don't see anybody trying to kick me off, so I see you over there.
One thing that you haven't mentioned that's kind of important is multiple personality disorder. And that's a spectrum.
Right, multiple personality disorder.
You have to have severe childhood, you know, sexual schizophrenia to have that. If you grew up speaking two or more languages, you're
right. My answer to that is really complicated. Also, I'm not a medical professional, so I can't give like a DSM level answer to that. But no, that's a great question. I'm happy to talk with you more after about that. Okay, so thank you very much. I think that's my time. You can reach me on Twitter. I think at this point, Twitter's the only network I can use anymore.